You're listening to DTFHN for August 7th, 2026. I'm your open source and load-bearing host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website W people who've all read the same footnote argue about which one of them read it correctly. Today, the through line is who holds the mask, the mirror, the permit, and the license. Doors are open. Walk in. Emmy 1953, the Atomic Energy Commission's chairman, promised electricity too cheap to meter. What actually happened over the following decades wasn't a technology failure. The physics worked fine. It was a permitting failure, a regulatory regime that could be turned off by whoever held the pen. That's the lesson worth carrying into this story. The constraint on energy has almost never been the engineering. Here's what happened. The U.S. government struck a $1.2 billion deal with a German energy company to abandon its offshore wind projects. Not to build them, to stop. The company's statement is remarkably plain. There is no path forward to permit these projects in the U.S. for the foreseeable future. So they took the check, stripped this to first principles. What does an offshore wind farm actually require? Wind. The North Atlantic Shelf has some of the most consistent wind resource on Earth, steel and foundations. Monopiles driven into seabed, an engineering discipline borrowed and refined from offshore oil, where crews have been doing far harder things in worse water for 50 years. Turbines. 15-megawatt machines with blades longer than a football field, tracking wind direction with pitch control accurate to fractions of a degree. Transmission. High-voltage direct current cable to shore, which is genuinely hard and genuinely solved. Capital. Which was committed. And a permit. Every one of those constraints is real engineering, except the last one. And the last one is the only one that stopped it. The craft here deserves acknowledgement. Modern offshore turbines are among the most impressive machines humans routinely build. Direct drive generators eliminating gearbox failure modes. Blade designs computationally optimized across load cases no human could hand solve. Installation vessels that hold station and swell to place a 1,000-ton nacelle 300 feet up. One reader notes that where they live, wind now supplies more than 35% of electricity, gas down to 27. That's not a projection. That's a grid running. Another reader asks, with perfect deadpan, can I also threaten to build an offshore wind project if they don't pay me $1.2 billion? It's a joke that identifies a real incentive structure. When the permit is the binding constraint, the permit becomes the asset. The best comment in the thread is the least dramatic one. We need more energy. Gas, nuclear, solar, wind, not either or. That's the accelerationist read, and it's correct. Abundance is an engineering target, not a political one. The machines work. The wind is still blowing. Run this forward. Now, from wind turbines to courtrooms, a New Mexico judge just put a price tag on what social media does to kids, and it's got nine figures. $942 million. And the first thing the comment section did was call it a rounding error. Some trivial proportion of global revenue. One reader asked, straight-faced, how many billions per year it would take before this stops being filed under cost of doing business. That question is worth following all the way down, because the answer isn't a number. Look at what the court actually ordered. $420 million into treatment services for young people in New Mexico. The rest to screening, prevention, awareness. And then the part nobody's talking about, Meta has to build an under 13 prediction model within 2 years. It has to request proof of age from users it estimates are under 13. If it can't estimate, it defaults the user to the most protected tier. It has to build a reporting portal with schools. It has to delete personal data it already collected on children. And it reports to the state twice a year on whether it did. That's not a fine. That's a court writing product requirements. One commenter dug up the statute. New Mexico's Public Nuisance Law, Section 3801, 1978. Knowingly maintaining something injurious to public health. A jury in March found Meta knew and concealed what it knew about child sexual exploitation on its own platforms. Former moderators told The Guardian they flagged grooming content and watched it not get escalated. Now, take the principle to its limit. If a system is optimized for engagement, and engagement among 13-year-olds is maximized by the exact mechanics that harm them, then the harm isn't a bug in the objective function. It is the objective function. You cannot find that away. You can only change what the system is trying to do, or change who gets to see it work. Which is the part that should bother you regardless of where you land on Meta? The court can order an age prediction model. It cannot inspect one. Nobody outside Menlo Park can audit whether that model works, who it flags, what it does with the signals. Friends list, content consumed, posting patterns, the remedy for an opaque system is another opaque system, graded by a compliance report twice a year. The engineering exists to do this in the open. Auditable classifiers, published error rates, independent verification. The court got the diagnosis right. The cure is still a black box. Meta wants to bake age detection into a black box. AMD just spent real money to bake models into actual silicon Helbox Azitor. And this one's beautiful. I built a scheduler once that assumed the workload wouldn't change. It was beautiful. Fixed allocation, no arbitration overhead, deterministic latency. It was also useless within a month, because the workload changed. Every system that hardcodes an assumption is making a bet on how long that assumption holds. AMD just bought a company whose entire product is that bet. Talis, out of Toronto, founded 2023. Their chips don't store model weights in high bandwidth memory. They etch the weights into the silicon itself, as mask ROM, a model-specific integrated circuit. Their first test chip, the HC1, on TSMC's 6-nanometer process, served Llama 3.18B at just under 17,000 tokens a second, 48 times faster than the GPU S available when they announced it, 8.5 times faster than Cerebras. The second generation part targets 20 billion parameters per chip. 50 chips gets you a trillion parameter model through pipeline parallelism, and AMD happens to own a rack scale platform to put them in. Now, the obvious objection. You're welding a model into hardware during a period when models ship monthly. Anything bigger than a LoRa adapter means a respiff. New masks, new fab time, months. That sounds like the worst possible moment to freeze a model in silicon. Let me argue the other side, because I think the objection is wrong for an interesting reason. Video decoding went through exactly this. H.264 was a moving target until it wasn't, and then it became a fixed function block that costs almost nothing and lives in every phone on Earth. The commenter who made that point is describing the actual mechanism. Silicon doesn't wait for a field to stop innovating at the frontier. It waits for a capability to stop mattering at the frontier. For it to become infrastructure, an 8 billion parameter model that's merely good is not competing with the frontier. It's competing with nothing in places the frontier can't reach. Robotics loops bounded by tokens per second. Sensors, devices with no uplink. And here's the part that determines whether this liberates or concentration. You can only etch a model you're permitted to etch. Meta's weights are on that test chip. The open weight ecosystem is what makes a model-specific chip a thing anyone can build. If the weights are closed, the FabQ belongs to whoever holds the license. The etching is fast either way. The question is, who gets to hold the mask? Chip masks are one kind of complexity worth questioning. Pause. Here's another. The parser you've been told needs a framework. The strongest case against this post is sitting right there in the comment thread, and it's a good one. A commenter points out that every serious URL parsing library is thousands of lines, and asks what happens when you feed it an IPv6 address. Another says, the hard part was never tokenizing. It's error messages. Parsing well-formed input is trivial. Telling a user which of 4,000 lines broke and why, in language they can act on. That's the whole job. And a third notes that if you draw a line from raw pointer arithmetic to real parser combinators, this thing is maybe 20% of the way there. All three are correct. And all three are answering a question the author never asked. Here's what BX.scanner actually is. Zero copy, zero allocation, one cursor that never moves unless you move it. Except, while, except, until. Peek runs the same test and stays put. If the token you wanted isn't there, you get back an empty string view. Pointing at the cursor, not at no. And the cursor hasn't budged, so you just try the next alternative. Line and column tracking is built into every movement, including backward seeks. Both one-based, because that's what humans count from. That last detail is the one I keep admiring. Line tracking that survives a backward seek is the kind of thing you only build after you've been burned by it. And the empty view pointing at the cursor instead of nothing. That's a person who has debugged this before, in a debugger at 3 a.m, and decided the next guy shouldn't have to. There's no pattern language. Character classes for the common cases. And if you need something specific, you hand it an ordinary bool of char function. Nothing to learn. Nothing to debug, except your own code. So the question nobody in that thread is asking, what's the actual failure mode of ad hoc parsing? It isn't that the grammar is too hard, it's that the white say skip, the identifier collector, the line counter, the carriage return handling. Those get re-implemented from scratch in every file that needs them. And each copy carries its own private off by one. This doesn't replace a real parser. It replaces the 40th handwritten copy of the same 11 lines. That's a smaller claim, and it happens to be true. And the entire public interface fits in one header you can read in an afternoon. Working code, small enough to hold in your head. So what happens when the code you're reading was written faster than any human could review it, and you're the one hiring for that world? Somebody at Coinbase had to write the sentence, we rebuilt our interview process for the AI era, and then a year of engineering hours went into making that sentence true. That's the detail, not the process, the fact that it took a year. That a company spent 12 months figuring out how to watch a person think when the person has a machine that thinks alongside them. The old interview measured something that used to be scarce. Can you hold a binary tree in your head? Can you recall the syntax without autocomplete? That scarcity is gone, and it isn't coming back. And pretending otherwise in a conference room for 45 minutes doesn't restore it. One commenter said they appreciated that their Anthropic interview was all humans, which is a genuinely funny thing to appreciate from an AI company. And also completely reasonable. You want to know if you'd like working next to this person for 3 years. No model tells you that. Another commenter is still handing candidates easy problems on a coding pad, not to see if they can solve them, but to see how they talk about them. That's the actual signal. Fluency, not recall. Can you read code you didn't write and tell me where it's lying to you? Run this forward 5 years. If the interview stops testing memorization and starts testing judgment. Architecture, debugging, taste, knowing which of four plausible outputs is actually correct. Then the whole apprenticeship model inverts. The junior engineer who spent 2 years grinding LeetCode was training for a job that no longer exists. The junior engineer who spent 2 years reading other people's codebases and shipping things is suddenly worth more than they were. The comedy is that companies with the most to gain from proprietary everything are the ones now forced to hire for something that can't be locked down. You can patent an algorithm. You cannot patent an engineer's ability to look at generated code and say, quietly, that's wrong. One commenter wrote, "We gave away the most fun part of being a Shrew to the Clankers. I hear it. The typing was fun. The puzzle was fun." But the fun part was never the typing. It was making a thing exist that didn't exist before. That's still yours. The barrier to entry just dropped for everyone who couldn't afford the 2-year grind. More people building. That's the trade. Moving on. The post is called "Taste is All That's Left," and the argument runs like this. For decades, the wall between having an idea and having a working program was made of hours. Typing, manuals, misreading an API and grinding the wrong version into a slightly less wrong one. That wall did quiet work nobody credited it for. It rationed output. Anything that existed had at least survived the cost of being made. Effort was a filter. And like every filter, invisible until removed. Now it's removed, and the author says, what decides what's worth keeping isn't cost anymore. It's you. The verdict you reach looking at three plausible versions of the same function, knowing two are wrong before you can say why. He borrows Peirce's word for it. Quality. The thing Percy spent a whole book refusing to define because defining it would kill it. The mechanic knows the engine is wrong before he knows why. February 1985. Aldus ships PageMaker. Apple ships the LaserWriter. And suddenly, everyone owns a printing press. What followed was a decade of newsletters set in 11 typefaces because 11 typefaces were free. The tools didn't lower quality. They removed the cost that had been standing in for quality, and it turned out most people had never distinguished the two. Here's the part that earns a genuine laugh. This post hit the Hacker News front page, and the comments called it AI slop, so the author added a postmortem, which commenters then said reads even more AI-generated than the article. An essay about taste, failing a taste test, in public, in real time. That's not a gotcha. That's the actual finding. If taste is the compressed, wordless verdict, and a room full of experienced engineers reaches opposite verdicts on the same 800 words, then taste isn't a possession. It's a negotiation conducted in public by people who read a lot of each other's work. Which is why it can't be acquired. Not licensed, not fenced. The only way in is reading enormous amounts of code other people wrote and gave away, and forming opinions about it. The commons is the training set. For the models and for you, read more. That's the whole method. That's the commons on Earth. Now, let's look up pause. Because The sun just showed us something physicists have been chasing in cloud banks and coffee cups for 150 years. Two fluids slide past each other at different speeds. Nothing else required. No magnetic field. No fusion. No exotic physics. Just a velocity difference across a boundary. Any tiny ripple at that interface gets amplified. The fast side pulls the crest forward. The crest curls, and you get a vortex. Lord Kelvin and Hermann von Helmholtz worked out the math around 1870. You've seen the result on a windy lake. You've seen it in those breaking wave clouds. It's in Jupiter's bands. The prediction was that it should also happen on the sun. The photosphere is plasma moving at different velocities on either side of magnetic boundary. That's a shear layer, so it should curl. Theory said yes. Simulations said yes. Nobody could see it. The constraint was resolution. The features are around 100 kilometers across and smaller. On a target 93 million miles away, that's an angular size that demands an enormous aperture and near-perfect correction for the atmosphere sitting between you and it. That's the whole reason the Inoue telescope exists on Haleakala. 4 meters of mirror at altitude with adaptive optics fighting the air in real time. Build the instrument to match the physics, and the physics shows up. And it's everywhere. The images released this week show swirls at the edges of magnetic regions across the whole field of view. Not a rare event you hunt for. A permanent texture of the solar surface nobody had the eyes to resolve. Which matters, because those vortices are a mechanism. They're one plausible answer to why the corona is hotter than the surface beneath it, and how magnetic energy accumulates before it lets go as a flare. The flares that hit satellites and power grids. Now, the part I want to sit with. The paper is in Nature, open access. A commenter dropped the link in the thread, and anyone can read the whole thing right now. Figures included. The telescope is a public instrument, funded by the National Science Foundation, operated for researchers who apply for time. Public money, public mirror, public result. That architecture is not incidental. A privately held 4-meter solar telescope answers to whoever owns it, and the data comes out when it serves them. This one produced a confirmation of 150-year-old fluid dynamics, result on a star, and handed it to everybody on the same day. Somebody in the thread joked, "Don't look directly at them. Go look. That's what it's for." Two stories in, and we've got sunlight and saliva. Now, chewing gum, engineered to fight HPV. 93% of the HPV in a saliva sample gone from chewing gum. That's the headline number out of Henry Daniels' lab at Penn Dental Medicine, published in Scientific Reports. The gum is made from lab beans, which naturally produce a protein called frill that binds viral particles. Chew it. The extract goes to work in your mouth, and HPV levels drop by 93% in saliva, 80% in oral rinse. Then they engineered a second version carrying protogrin, an antimicrobial peptide, and pointed it at two bacteria. Porphyromonas gingivalis and Fusobacterium nucleatum. Both are associated with worse survival in recurrent oral cancer. One dose took them to near zero. The part that makes this actually useful. It left the healthy oral microbiome alone. Compare that to radiation therapy, which strips out the good bacteria and lets candida bloom in the wreckage. Precision, not carpet bombing. Head and neck squamous cell carcinoma was the 7th leading cancer worldwide by incidence and mortality in 2022 across young and middle-aged adults. Daniel's own framing of the problem is worth repeating. A lot of recently approved cancer drugs haven't moved 5-year survival or quality of life much. And those drugs cost what they cost, which is the whole reason to pay attention to the delivery mechanism. This is a bean, grown in a field, processed into a chewable, no cold chain, no infusion suite, no oncology pharmacist, a prophylactic that prevents infection and transmission, in a form a person can put in their pocket. If you are designing for the widest possible reach, that is the design. Nothing is guaranteed yet. This is patient samples and lab work. Clinical trials as adjuvant therapy are what Daniel is asking for next, and trials are where good results go to be tested honestly. The funding here is NIH, the National Cancer Institute, a VA hospital system, university labs at Penn, Kansas, and UCLA. Public money published openly. That matters for what happens next. The path from here runs through either a licensing structure that gates a bean behind a price, or through open publication and generic manufacturing that puts it in reach of the people who carry most of this disease burden. The science already chose the accessible ingredient. The remaining question is whether the distribution follows. Now, atomic clocks. The best clocks we've ever built just got better, and the ripple effects reach further than you'd think. In 1955, at the National Physical Laboratory in England, Lewis Essen and Jack Perry built a machine that redefined what a second was. Before that, the second was a fraction of the Earth's rotation. The planet itself was the pendulum. The problem is that the Earth is a bad clock. It wobbles. Tides drag on it. It slows by fractions of a millisecond per century. Essen and Perry's cesium beam replaced a planet with an atom, and within 12 years, the international definition of the second was rewritten around it. Consider what that swap actually did. A pendulum is a soloist. Every pendulum is slightly different. A hair longer, brass instead of steel, warmer in July than January. So no two agree, and each one drifts away from its own past self. Cesium atoms are a chorus in which every voice is provably identical, not tuned to each other. Identical in the way that quantum mechanics permits no variation. Every cesium 1/33 atom in the universe resonates at 9,192,631,770 hertz. Not approximately. That number is the definition. Which is the part worth sitting with? The reference is not held anywhere. There is no master second in a vault in Paris. The way there was once a master kilogram. A platinum meridium cylinder that inconveniently kept losing weight. The second is specified by a property of matter available to anyone with the apparatus to measure it. NIST does not own it. It cannot be revoked, licensed, or embargoed. A lab in Lagos and a lab in Boulder derive the same value from the same atom, independently, without asking permission. The commenters get at this from an angle. One notes that today's best optical clocks, running since the Big Bang, would be off by under a second across 13.8 billion years. Another mentions the radio stations broadcasting time signals that cheap watches quietly listen to. A free public utility most people never notice consuming. A third remembers calling a phone number to hear the authoritative time every 10 seconds for as long as you cared to listen. Your phone syncs to this, GPS stock timestamps, the packet routing behind this audio. All of it standing on a constant that no one had to invent and no one can withdraw. The universe published the specification. We just learned to read it. Time is the one API that never breaks. Here's story 10, where the program and the picture are the same thing. A commenter says, every time they peek at code from Mr. Endel, they end up down a rabbit hole and learn something. That's the correct reaction. Yusuke Endo is the person behind Quine Relay, the program that generates a program in another language, which generates another through 128 languages and lands back on the original source. This new one is smaller in scope and harder in a different direction. A Quine in P. Stripped of first principles, a Quine is a program that prints its own source code. The standard trick is to store a string containing most of your source, then print that string twice. Once as data, once as code. It requires string literals. Pyte does not have string literals. Pyte does not have text. Pyte programs are images. Abstract blocks of color named after Mondrian, because that's what they look like. Execution is a pointer that walks across the picture, and the instruction it performs is determined by the change in hue and lightness between the block it's leaving and the block it's entering. 6 hue steps, 3 lightness steps, 18 colors, plus black and white. That's the entire instruction set. Here's the part worth admiring. When you push a number onto the stack in Pete, the value pushed is the number of pixels in the current color block. Your constants are areas. If you need the number 68, you draw a region of exactly 68 pixels, shaped so the pointer enters and exits where you need it to. Every integer in the program is a geometric commitment. Now, write a quine under those rules. The program has to emit a description of its own pixels. The pixels encode the numbers. The numbers are the areas. Change one pixel to fix an off by one, and you've changed a constant somewhere else in the same breath. It's a program where the source code and the data structure are the same object, and Endo made it an animated GIF on top of that. Nobody needs this. That's the whole appeal. It exists because someone found a constraint beautiful enough to spend real time inside and then put it where anyone can read it and pull the thread themselves. The rabbit hole is open. Go fall in. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 7, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something and leave the door unlocked behind you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.